Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Christian Studies. I'm Crawford Gribben, the host of the channel. Today, we're going to be talking to Zoe Knox. Zoe is the Associate Professor in Modern Russian History at the University of Leicester. And we're going to be talking to Zoe about her new book, Jehovah's Witnesses and the Secular World from the 1870s to the Present. It's just been published by Palgrave. Zoe, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I can. So my early work was actually on quite a different religious tradition. I worked on the Russian Orthodox Church, and I became very interested in the church's role in the late Soviet period and the early post-Soviet period, the way it was shaping discourse in Russia about religious pluralism, about democracy, about human rights, about religious tolerance. And the more I looked at this, the more I came across one particular religious community that troubled the leadership of the Russian Orthodox Church, and that was a community called the Jehovah's Witnesses. They weren't a group I knew much about, but what I quickly became aware of was that the language used to demonize this religious community in the Soviet period and in the post-Soviet period was very similar, despite the fact that these were two very different regimes. And so I started to ask questions about what it was about this particular community that caused such controversy and that led them to be a target. And that is how I ended up researching this book we're talking about this morning.
That's fascinating. So your earlier work was in a different subject precisely, I suppose, but many of the same themes come through into this one. Tell us a little bit about the Jehovah's Witnesses. How many are there, first of all?
So the Watchtower Organization, that's the corporate body of Jehovah's Witnesses, they keep very clear records on the number of witnesses worldwide. So I'm able to answer that with some precision. They count just over 8 million members worldwide. It's worth saying that there's something quite distinct, I think, about the way they do calculate their membership and the way they do arrive at that figure, that that number only includes active witnesses, those that are involved with congregations and that are regarded as witnesses in good standing, that have some presence in congregational life, I suppose. So 8 million doesn't sound like a lot when we're talking about the figures worldwide, but actually when you consider that the vast majority of those will be actively involved in the organisation, that seems to be far more significant than numerically.
Huh. Now, in that 8 million, or among that 8 million, there's a number of famous people.
Yes, that's right. The organisation doesn't do much to play up its celebrity membership. This is not something it celebrates the way, for instance, the Church of Scientology might. But probably the most famous witness of modern times must be Michael Jackson. Also Prince, the Williams sisters, the tennis players, they're some of the key celebrities, I suppose, that emerged from this tradition or were raised in this tradition, or in some cases converted later. As in Prince's case, he was converted by one of the members of Sly and the Family Stone.
Would each of these individuals be regarded as being in good standing?
That's a good question. There was some material in Watchtower Publications after Michael Jackson's smash hit Thriller was released that condemned the connections to the occult and warned young people not to be drawn into belief systems that in any way kind of referenced the occult or the undead. You might remember the video clip featuring those kind of zombies rising from their graves and so on.
Very seasonal this week.
Yeah, yes, that's right. So that was criticized by the organization itself. And I think by the time he died, he wasn't regarded as a witness in good standing, unlike Prince, who I understand was.
Interesting, interesting. At one point in the book, you describe a habit in the earlier part of the movement's history of convening mass meetings. And I think you mentioned that one mass meeting in the later 1950s was the largest religious gathering ever recorded in history.
Well, it would be very difficult to be firm about that. It's certainly the way it was reported at the time. That's the way the Los Angeles Times reported it, at least. This is an event that I would like to look at far more closely, and I think I might return and do some archival work on this. But it was in 1958, and it was an international convention of Jehovah's Witnesses held in New York City, in the end at a number of different sites across New York City, including Yankee Stadium, the old Polo Grounds, which have since been demolished, and some of the baptisms happened off the of some of the nearby beaches. But this was an enormous event, filled Yankee Stadium to capacity, and really that was the last time that the organization tried to get witnesses from all over the world together in one place. They still have very large conventions and large meetings, but generally they have delegates from different countries rather than inviting every witness to come to one place. And actually, a picture of Yankee Stadium filled to capacity is what's on the cover of the book. I found this such an interesting illustration of their global spread, of their expansion in post-World War II America, and of the way they really generated a high profile right in the right in the center of New York City.
That's fascinating. So with that high profile in the centre of the world's most important city, arguably, with celebrity members and with 8 million dedicated witnesses operating within the community, it's hard sometimes to think of this in terms of what we would often consider to be a cult or a sect. Now, there's obviously a very negative public opinion about the witnesses. You use a very specific kind of social scientific language to describe them. Could you just talk us through how you did that?
Well, I was very aware from the outset that this was a project that I had to be very careful about, and I had to be very aware of the kind of terminology I was using to describe this very controversial, very high-profile religious community. I sought to move away from any labels, really, even new religious movement that's often adopted as seen as a more impartial term to describe religious movements that emerged in late 19th century and 20th century. Even that was incorrect in lots of ways. They're not very new. They emerged in the 1870s. We can't really describe them as a movement. They're very highly organized. They've been around for 150 years by this stage. So I sought to free my study from some of the language which has dominated academic assessments of the witnesses, and in that way I hope take an approach that's more balanced than much of the historical scholarship on the organization. I'm not from within the community myself. I wasn't raised in this tradition, and I hope that gave me a critical distance that did make this more balanced. It's up to the reader to judge, I suppose.
Yeah, no, it's a really fine work. You emphasise this as a highly disciplined, highly centralised, highly organised community. You also explain in various parts of the book that there's a schismatic tradition as well. There are other groups who trace common intellectual origins back to Russell, for example, and perhaps some other early Bible students, but they would see themselves as being different from the Watchtower organization.
Yes. So I mentioned that the movement first emerged in the 1870s and was formed around a really fascinating man, Charles Taze Russell. He had a very high profile in his own day. His sermons were carried in newspapers right across North America and well beyond as well. He traveled a lot himself, far and wide, to the outer reaches of the Russian Empire, to Palestine, all over the world. He was a very controversial figure, but he was always also very willing to engage with other religious figures of the day. So a number of high-profile debates, with particularly with Protestant theologians and Protestant clergy as well. Because he was such a controversial figure, when he died in October 1916, there were some very significant ruptions within the organisation itself. And some splits emerged then, but really ever since, there have been schismatic tendencies within the movement. Most of the groups which emerged, and one sociologist has counted around 40 schismatic groups that emerged after Russell's death, most of them has long since disappeared. There are a number of strands that still have a profile, but they're far, far smaller than the Jehovah's Witnesses.
Fascinating. So the group emerged, what, in the 1870s, 1880s, I think?
In the 1870s, they first began when groups of men calling themselves ecclesias met to study scripture. They wanted to return to the Bible to clearly identify some of the chronological elements that would tell them about the timing of the Second Advent. And these groups, as they became more coherent, started to, I guess, hammer out a more a clearer theology for themselves. And they came to have clarity on certain aspects of the Bible. And they came to call themselves Bible students to indicate their close study of Scripture and to give themselves an identity as a community. So that's how they began. So they were called Bible students until 1931, mm-hmm. when Russell's successor, a man called Joseph Rutherford, decreed that their name henceforth would be Jehovah's Witnesses. I should also note that although they called themselves Bible students in the early years of the movement, they were popularly known as Russellites. And that's because of Russell's high profile and because, of course, he was the fountainhead.
Fascinating. So from this very almost otherworldly emphasis of discussion in the 1870s, 1880s, the movement becomes an organisation with very clear emphases in terms of politics. One of the things that your book does really well is to show how this group has made an extraordinary contribution to human rights, for example.
Yes, all over the world, they've really been at the forefront of pushing for concessions from government authorities and state authorities that will allow them to minister in their own distinctive way and that will not put up any obstacles to their ministry. They're also, as a highly centralised organisation, they are quite litigious and have been since the early days. And they're very willing to take their cases to the highest courts, which is why we see landmark Supreme Court cases in the United States beginning in the late 1930s, continuing through the 40s and 50s, right up until the early 21st century, really. And we also see multiple cases before the European Court of Human Rights as well, based on religious freedom issues. So it's because they're constantly pushing at the boundaries of what's acceptable religious practice, coupled with the fact they're willing to take their cases to the highest courts of law. Those two things have led them to, I would argue, define religious tolerance in many ways in countries all over the world.
So we tell us What's their attitude to politics in that case? If they are litigious, if they are pressing for their rights, and if others are actually benefiting from that pressing for their own rights, are they actively involved in the political culture of the communities in which they work?
That's a really interesting question. The Watchtower organization teaches that Jehovah's Witnesses should stand aloof from the secular world, because the secular world, the world around them, is corrupt. And so they shouldn't take hold positions of political office. They shouldn't vote. They shouldn't lobby political parties or individuals. They also think that it's not worthwhile being involved in civic organizations. And so actually they don't involve themselves in political organizations at all. Instead, I suppose what stands in for lobbying is that legal emphasis that I mentioned earlier. That's the way they put their case forward.
So Zoe, one of the ways in which you illustrate their apolitical stance is to indicate in how many places they were made illegal during the Second World War.
Yes, that's right. Their position of political neutrality, this expectation that they'll stand aloof from the secular world, means that they won't be involved in fighting earthly wars and secular wars. So during times of war especially, they become a challenge to the state, who can't easily enroll them in patriotic projects or indeed get them to sign up for military service or in other ways perform duties when conscripted. And they were made illegal in Australia because there was a belief that they were transmitting military secrets to the Japanese. The Witnesses had a number of radio stations in Adelaide, and they believed that it was through that they were trying to undermine the Allied war effort. So, yes, illegal in Australia and a highly controversial case. So during times of war especially, they become problematic for states. In the United States, for instance, it's during World War II that there is mob violence against witnesses all over America, burning of kingdom halls, lynching, beating up individual witnesses, to the point that the ACLU described it as the greatest level of violence against any religious community since the Mormons. Mm. So they are targets during times of war. Of course, in Nazi Germany, they're imprisoned in the concentration camps for their refusal to Heil Hitler, and in other ways show their support for the regime.
Hmm. You give us an example of witness activity in Australia, I think it is, where cars are driving by with loudspeakers parked outside or driving slowly past churches where services are being held with a view to disrupting them. But habits of evangelization have changed over the years for the witnesses too, haven't they?
Yes, that's right. And they've actually been quick to adopt new technologies in order to advance their theology. So that example you gave of sound cars, it wasn't just in Australia they were used. It was far more widely, so they would have amplified sound. This is another case in the States that went to the Supreme Court a little bit later. But sound cars, information marches, they would call them, where they would march through city streets wearing sandwich boards. So they've adopted different technologies. Early on, actually a first really in motion picture history was a film that was produced under Russell's direction, which was narrated by Russell and then travelled all over the world being filmed for free to audiences. So they're quick to adopt different techniques in order to spread their word. A very recent change, and this may be what you're referring to, are the literature stands that we started to see perhaps about 5 or 6 years ago, stands in major thoroughfares, outside train stations, shopping centres. There's often a stand outside my university. And this is a recognition of changing times. People are busy. People are rushing past. They're more likely perhaps to catch somebody's eye walking past than they are to engage them in meaningful conversation on their doorstep. So their ministry techniques are always evolving.
Can you tell us a little bit more about their attitude to blood transfusions?
So I have the longest chapter in the book actually is on blood and is on the blood issue. The reason I was so interested in this is because the witness's position on blood transfusion is fascinating. They accept medical intervention of all different sorts, and they're very familiar with different medical techniques, and they welcome medical intervention where needed. It's only transfusion in particular that is frowned on by the Watchtower organization. As you know, it teaches that witnesses should not accept blood transfusions. This is a position that first emerged immediately after World War II, when transfusion became more commonplace. And the leadership of the organization looked back at biblical scripture and interpreted certain passages as meaning that blood was a was sullying the body, that it was a corrupting influence, and that it's true Christians shouldn't accept transfusion. And for that reason, they reject it for themselves and for their children as well.
Well, after that chapter on blood, Zoe, you've got a big chapter on religion as well. How does this group or this movement refer to or look upon Christian bodies, Christian denominations?
So the Watchtower organization teaches that Jehovah's Witnesses are the only true Christians, and that every other denomination, every other tradition, every other iteration is errant. And they believe, in fact, that the other churches are doing Satan's bidding by pulling people away from true Christianity. They criticize especially what they see as the corrupt nature of the Christian churches, their cooperation with politics, their cooperation with commerce, and they see them as essentially corrupt, misleading, misguided. They're very critical of clergy and other Christian traditions, again, for leading people away from the true faith and from true Christianity. And that's the reason behind their lack of involvement in any kind of ecumenical projects. In fact, they firmly reject the whole idea of ecumenism. And they don't cooperate with other faiths on any issues whatsoever. So heavily critical of the other churches.
Now, this position has also changed over time a little bit, hasn't it? Didn't in the early days, I think you talk about Russell's somewhat cautiously positive view of Baptists, I think?
Initially, Russell did say that some religious denominations were less errant than others, and that some were closer to the truth than others. And as I mentioned earlier, Russell was willing to debate some of the key issues of the day with clergymen and with some theologians. So he was willing to interact and engage in dialogue with representatives of other Christian churches. Now, this changes quite dramatically with under Rutherford, who becomes president after Russell's death. Rutherford far more vehemently rejects any kind of exchange, interchange, cooperation with other churches. And his screeds really against particularly Catholicism are one of the reasons why in many countries governments move against the witnesses and start to see them as offensive. And in many levels, what they were doing was highly offensive. So I have in mind the distribution of pamphlets in Quebec, for instance, in French and English and Ukrainian, that were heavily criticizing the Vatican and the Roman Catholic hierarchy, painting them as doing the devil's work and so on. And I think there was something like a million copies of that tract distributed around Quebec. Wow. So a lot of the time the controversy is invited by their own, the vehemence in their own language. And this is particularly in the 1930s and in the 1940s as well under President Rutherford.
Hmm. So Zoe, one of the interesting comments that you make in the chapter on religion is to compare Rutherford's position, or rather Rutherford's critique of other religious bodies, with the Marxist critique of religion. What kinds of themes were you getting at when you made that kind of observation?
Both Rutherford and Marxist ideologues see religious institutions as being fundamentally exploitative and as trying to mislead people and close their eyes to the truth and take their attention away from the real causes of strife and division in society. And so Rutherford had some similar arguments. I don't think we can take that comparison too far, but sometimes when I'm reading some of the material in the 1930s, it does sound close to Marxist critique, particularly when he said religion and commerce and politics were all part of the same kind of corrupt game, I suppose. So Rutherford used the term religion in a very negative way, and he sought to disassociate the Jehovah's Witnesses from religion. Now, the way the organization has used that term has also changed since the Rutherford period, but that was something I thought that drew a connection between Marxism and Rutherford.
The title of your book, Jehovah's Witnesses in the Secular World from the 1870s to the Present, wants us to think about what this relationship should be. And a lot of your work in the book is very telling in terms of developing how witnesses have created a almost secular space for themselves within the wider world, in that their campaign for human rights, for example, or for state neutrality in religion somehow benefits them. Are they actually wanting a secular world, or is the secular world something they wish to change?
I think the secular world really is the fallen world, and they look forward to the day when it will be destroyed, and what will be left will be the earthly paradise or the heavenly paradise that true Christians, in other words, Jehovah's Witnesses, will occupy. But they're in a very interesting position because they need to operate within the secular world in the meantime. And they go to ordinary schools and they live amongst non-witnesses, and they strive to be good citizens and to follow the laws of the state whenever they don't contravene Jehovah's laws. So they're in the world, but in profound tension with it, I suppose. And it's some of those tensions, some of those theological points that bring that tension that I've tried to explore in the book.
Fascinating. Well, Zoe, we've taken up a lot of your time today, but before we wind up, could you tell us what you're working on at the moment? What will your next project be?
Well, I'm very excited about this. Now that this book is finished, I am going to begin work on Russell. There's not been much work on Russell, and he was the founder leader of Jehovah's Witnesses, huge, a household name in his day, a prolific writer, engaged with some of the key thinkers of the day, and yet we don't have much on him. So I'm going to go back and look at where he came from and those early days of the movement, the development of the ecclesias and so on, for my next project. And I'm, as you said at the beginning, I'm an associate professor of modern Russian history. Russell went to the Russian Empire, and I'm very interested to know how, when he did those speaking tours, he was received in those kinds of places, this very unusual message from this American religious organization. How is this being received in places like, well, modern day Moldova, for instance, as it now is?
That sounds really exciting. Well, listen, thanks for coming on today. Thanks for telling us about your book, Jehovah's Witnesses in the Secular World from the 1870s to the Present. Thanks for your time, and take care.
Well, thank you. Thank you for reading it so carefully, and thank you to your listeners.
Thank you, Zoe.